It has taken technology almost two millennia to break one of the greatest secrets of the ancient Americas. Archaeologists have discovered a recreation of the underworld at the ancient city of Teotihuacan in Mexico. Thanks to a radar device, researchers have only advanced 7 meters along the tunnel, but the radar has revealed it to be 120 meters long and covered with symbols. It is thought that the passage leads to three chambers and may help explain the beliefs of the civilization. A description of a recently discovered tunnel, and that tunnel is just one of the features of the mysterious place described as Mexico's first great city, Teotihuacan. It's a place that once had a population of 100,000 or more. What forces made that city such a hub? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What was life like in Mexico 1,500 years ago and more? What caused the collapse and abandonment of Teotihuacan and other great cities? And what are the latest discoveries there telling us about the politics and religion of that place and those times? Our guest is archaeologist Sarah Clayton, professor of anthropology at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
I have to start by asking you, why is it that if we know quite a bit about ancient Greece and Rome and ancient Egypt, why is it that for most of us, Teotihuacan is not only a place that's hard to pronounce, but is a place we know very little about?
That's a really good question. Actually, that's something that struck me when I first visited Teotihuacan, and that was when I had started graduate school. I planned on specializing in the Maya, and I had spent a few years excavating Maya sites, participating on field projects in Belize, for example. But when I visited Teotihuacan, one of the things that I was sort of amazed by was my own kind of lack of awareness of it, and considering that it really was one of the earliest major urban states of Mesoamerica and of the Americas in general, it's always surprised me that it has such a minor role in the educative curriculum about American prehistory.
And it's near one of the biggest cities in the world now, and that's actually part of the problem, isn't it?
That
Mexico City is sprawling across what used to be Teotihuacan.
Mexico City presents a serious challenge to archaeologists who are interested in Teotihuacan and also antecedent civilizations. The Toltecs, the Aztecs. It's a city that has more than 20 million people at this point in the greater metropolitan area, and a lot of the sites have been destroyed. Without protection, they continue to be endangered cultural resources. And so that's one of the issues. Teotihuacan itself is protected. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. But what's protected is a small area that really represents the civic ceremonial core of the city. And so it's visited. It may be the most visited archaeological site in Mexico. But the area where people lived, the suburbs, the rural parts, even the outer part of what we might consider downtown Teotihuacan, is not in a protected zone, and so it continues to be developed.
Have we known about these structures, the heart of Teotihuacan, for really all along?
I think Teotihuacan may be one of the least lost ancient cities of the Americas. You know, it's not like Maya cities that were rediscovered having been kind of gobbled up by the jungle around them. Teotihuacan is in an arid environment. It's a very open landscape, and it's very difficult to lose track of something the size of the Sun Pyramid, which is about 1.8 million cubic meters. And so this is a site that has had archaeology happening there for a very long time, even beginning perhaps with the Aztec civilization, who excavated in areas of Teotihuacan. But certainly, by the early part of the 20th century, structures were being restored, tunnels were being dug, and people were preparing the area for tourist development.
Can you give us some basics? Go back to how old is this place? And
sure.
You know, what does it look like? Who were the inhabitants of this place?
Teotihuacan really developed in the early centuries B.C., so by about A.D. 1 to A.D. 100, it had at least 20,000 to 40,000 people living there. And that population grew really rapidly to at least 100,000. That's kind of a conservative estimate.
And how do we know? Like archaeologists, what kinds of evidence do they use that would give them figures like that?
Well, with Teotihuacan, it's really kind of a unique case where we've benefited from some well-conceived, very well-planned-out mapping projects, particularly in the 1960s. There was a project called the Teotihuacan Mapping Project that was collaborative and lasted for about 3 years of continuous mapping and survey, a collection of artifacts from the surface, and a few excavations just to generate kind of a basic stratigraphic chronology of the city. So digging down deep to see how many layers there were, to radiocarbon date some of the materials that were found, and to kind of build a temporal framework for the occupation of Teotihuacan. But that project mapped 30 square kilometers in total, so the entire downtown area and basically the suburbs of the city, which are now under people's backyards and houses and farms and that sort of thing. So Teotihuacan is a city that we know really well, but survey and surface collection only can kind of get us so far. So we have a knowledge of how many people probably existed in this given area, how many people might have lived in the dwellings that were recorded that were visible on the surface in the form of walls that were exposed, or scatters of artifacts, ceramics, lithics, obsidian. Those kinds of things are really common. And actually walking around the area, you can see polished floors. You can pick up ceramics from the surface. That's at the archaeological zone that you can visit as a tourist, but also just walking around the neighborhoods in the modern municipalities that surround Teotihuacan.
What attracted those 100,000 people to that place? Didn't you say it's arid?
I think the idea now is basically that a lot of factors were at work and that we have to kind of consider different motivations that a variety of different people might have had and chain reactions through time. So that as the city started to grow, how did motivations for moving there then change? And so the factors themselves are dynamic. But one of the hypotheses that's been out there for a very long time has to do with natural disaster, actually. So the Basin of Mexico is in an area with a lot of volcanoes and volcanic activity. And even as we speak, Popocatépetl is an active volcano in Puebla that just recently shot up a plume of 3 kilometers of ash into the air, which then fell over Puebla. So in prehistory, those volcanoes were active as well. And early in Teotihuacan's history as a settlement, but not yet as a state, not yet as the capital of a major expansive state, it had a competitor in the Basin of Mexico, a site called Cuicuilco, which is located in the southwestern part of the Basin of Mexico. And actually now the National School of Archaeology and History is located on that site of Cuicuilco. But Cuicuilco was covered, it was destroyed by pyroclastic flow from a volcano called Xitle. And now it's very difficult to excavate. It would take a lot of money and resources because part of it is covered really in solid rock that's in some areas 6 meters thick or so.
So that would be different from the experience at Herculaneum and Pompeii in Italy, for example, which were also covered by volcanoes, but were a real treasure trove?
You know, it's different in that it's more difficult to access. And so there are some areas that have been excavated. For example, we know there was a round pyramid at Cuicuilco. And it's there on the campus of the National School of Archaeology and History. But some of the more humble household areas are really difficult to identify. That solid rock that covers the area doesn't allow for the recognition of the normal kinds of archaeological markers that we might see, like the lithics and ceramics on the surface that we can collect just walking around Teotihuacan. So the idea for a long time has been that the eruption of Xitle really eliminated a competitor for resources in the basin, and that allowed for Teotihuacan to develop. Unfortunately, maybe unfortunately, we found out recently that volcano actually erupted during the height of Teotihuacan. And so that kind of threw that hypothesis out the window, perhaps. However, looking to the east to Puebla, where Popocatépetl is, they actually found out that volcano had erupted in somewhere between BC 200 and AD 1. And that was exactly when Teotihuacan was developing.
Right.
So it turns out that we can look to natural disasters and these kinds of catastrophes as motivations for people to move. But that's not the complete story necessarily. So people from Puebla, for example, They had volcano effigies in their homes. They actually worshipped the volcano. This is a part of their daily ritual lives. They have little models of volcanoes that were in the pre-classic homes of Pueblan sites. And so this was a part of their concept of cosmology and religion.
Are there any temples or equivalent of that the way with ancient Greece you can find temples to particular gods? You know, what kind of religious structures exist?
There are major pyramids at Teotihuacan, and this is why it always strikes me as so interesting that we know so little about it. I notice with my own students that come into my intro to archaeology classes, they've heard of the Aztecs, they've heard of the Maya and the Inca, and they're really completely unaware of Teotihuacan, and yet there are three major pyramids there that are really on par with pyramids at Giza, for example. Slightly smaller, but almost the same size at the base. They're some of the largest structures in the world. And as far as a religious kind of landscape, aside from temples, and there are temples, there are at least 100 kind of temple structures that line the central avenue at Teotihuacan. But those pyramids echo the shapes of mountains in the background. So there's all these mountains that ring the site. And the pyramid has the shape of those sacred mountains. There are also man-made caves that are dug underneath the main pyramid, the Sun Pyramid, which is the largest one at Teotihuacan. There's a cave that you would enter from the base front of the pyramid that goes all the way, was dug all the way back to the bottom, and so that the summit of the pyramid is actually directly above the end point of that cave. And so I think that they were really building a sacred landscape that you could move through, and that these were structures that were to be honored, maybe even kind of deified as architecture.
Give us a map of the city then.
The city is bisected by a very, very large, maybe 50-meter-wide avenue that runs from south to north. It goes for about 5 kilometers and is capped on the north by the Moon Pyramid. On the east part of the city is the Sun Pyramid, and just south of that is a huge enclosure called the Ciudadela, which would have been able to comfortably have 100,000 people gather there, so basically all of the population of Teotihuacan.
Kind of like a coliseum or a big auditorium. Is it open-air?
Yeah, it's a big open space with a pyramid that's inside that enclosure as well, and it's... There are all of these platforms that are placed around the Ciudadela so that there were different levels that you could stand on. So it's not quite a coliseum, but it's kind of an open space that many people could have gathered, kind of like a flat plaza, and with platforms around it that maybe particular members of the population could have enjoyed whatever political event or religious event was taking place there.
Or even sporting event, perhaps?
Could be a sporting event. Definitely there's the ball game that's known from Maya society and from West Mexican societies in prehistory. And there are no ball courts at Teotihuacan, but that doesn't mean they didn't play. You know,
It could have been shuffleboard.
It could be. And, you know, maybe we don't recognize exactly what they used as a ball court, but I wouldn't be surprised if they played it. And it's certainly depicted in their art as well.
When you mentioned the Pyramid of the Sun and the Moon and the temple structures, I think 100 of them lining this central avenue, mm-hmm. Is there any particular orientation toward sunrise,
yes.
Solstice, sunrise,
there's
that kind
actually,
of thing here?
Well, what strikes you when you visit Teotihuacan, at least for me, is the sense of order. Not necessarily symmetry, but a little bit of that, because you have the avenue framed by these temple platforms, and everything is oriented in the same way. It's 15.5 degrees east of north, specifically, and that's taken on kind of the nickname of Teotihuacan North. And that applies not only to the major pyramids and the major avenues, the Avenue of the Dead, which is that avenue that runs from south to north, but also the East-West Avenue. It's all aligned in that way, in addition to some of the major residential structures, most
Why?
Of them.
Yeah, that's pretty careful urban planning.
The latitude doesn't quite line up with that, does it? It's a little north of that 15-degree line, isn't it?
It's a really good question. I don't think we know. I mean, people have looked at alignments of stars, Venus, the Pleiades. It's also been said that the Pyramid of the Sun actually faces the sunset on August 12th, which is the beginning of the Maya long count calendar.
Right, yes, right.
So there are these calendrical factors that may have been involved. But ultimately, I mean, we don't really know what the meaning was. Maybe it was just some structure started out that way and everything else had to fall in line because that's what the ruler said. I mean, certainly we can see that there were very capable, very ambitious rulers that were able to plan and execute these major public works and these major monuments.
And did they move pretty quickly to get it? I mean, can you tell whether it was built in a hurry? Because it seems as if you have things kind of laid out, it would it would suggest that they planned it and built it fairly quickly.
Right, right. There's some disagreement about that. There are people that are doing wonderful research into those major monuments. One researcher, Saburo Sugiyama, has been excavating in the Feathered Serpent Pyramid, which is the pyramid inside that Ciutadella enclosure, the Moon Pyramid, and most recently the Sun Pyramid. And his idea is that these things were built based on a master plan, that everything is aligned just for that reason, that it was all conceived of from the beginning. But there are other researchers that would disagree with that. One of the participants of the mapping project and an expert on Teotihuacan, his name is George Kogel, was actually the advisor to Saburo Sugiyama. So they get along quite well, but this is part of what propels archaeology forward are these slight disagreements. But he thinks that things maybe were added later on. So the Feathered Serpent Pyramid was constructed a couple hundred years perhaps after the Moon Pyramid, for example, which is the earliest structure at Teotihuacan. So we don't really know. What we can tell, though, is that some of these structures were built in phases. And so the Moon Pyramid, for example, has seven different levels to it. So there are early parts of the Moon Pyramid that, in fact, do not align to Teotihuacan north. They're not 15.5 degrees east of north. But by the third structure or so, they do align with that.
There were
some episodes of remodeling.
Now, how do we know that it was called the Avenue of the Dead?
Actually, that's what the Aztecs called it. We don't know what Teotihuacanos called themselves. We don't know what language they spoke, and we don't know what they called the city or their civilization. All of those words come from the later Aztec language of Nahuatl. Whether Teotihuacanos actually spoke Nahuatl is another mystery. There are other potential candidates. Otomi, for example, was spoken in the ancient basin of Mexico and was still being spoken in the post-classic period when the Aztecs were there speaking Nahuatl. Also, Miche-Zocayan languages from Veracruz, from the Gulf Coast area. Some of those are a language from that family would be a candidate for Teotihuacan.
And is there any meaning to the word in the Aztec language? I mean, why did they call it that?
To Teotihuacan? Mm-hmm. That means in Nahuatl, the place where divinity came into being. Mm. And so often in the popular literature I read, the place where the gods were created. And that sounds close enough to me.
Well, yes, I can see where there would be a distinction there. Did they create themselves or did somebody help them out? Getting back to this site map of the city, mm-hmm. and you describe it then as kind of a quadrant system almost. I mean, it's bisected north and south and east and west.
It's got four quadrants. It's also bisected by a canalized river, the Rio San Juan, which would have been an important source for water, for irrigation, for drinking, all of that. So there are major public works that go beyond the pyramids, which are, of course, best known and best celebrated, but also apartment compounds in which people lived, the major thoroughfares, the canals. All of these things would have taken a lot of energy and labor to build as well.
Assume there were good sections of town and not so good sections of town?
That's a good question. That's something that I've thought about. And I don't think we have the answer to that yet. I think that more research is probably necessary. That's something we're working on, is really developing a kind of social topography of Teotihuacan. That's where some of the future research is going. But I think that even if these sort of corners of town or sides of town didn't start out carrying those kinds of social meanings, or if the leaders didn't plan for them to take on a social meaning, ultimately they sometimes do. I mean, we know from our own society, you know, any given
right.
town where we live sometimes the east
tends
side or the west side
gravitate
take
one way
on
or the other.
Certain characteristics that are social and socially that's significant.
To it would be fun to hear what a Teotihuacan real estate agent, you know, would use as their pitch.
Absolutely.
You want something close to the temple,
the
you know.
Sure.
Pay more for that.
You've mentioned rulers a couple of times. When we continue in a moment, we'll look at the governing structure of Teotihuacan. Back in a moment with more University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Sarah Clayton, who has been spending a good deal of time as an archaeologist in one of the world's most prominent cities, at least 1,500 years ago, Teotihuacan in Mexico, near what is now Mexico City. And we have mentioned these other groups, the Incas, the Aztecs, the Maya, with which we're all familiar, and you said we're, of course, collectively less familiar with the people who built Teotihuacan. So line these up for us and put them in place geographically and chronologically before we proceed to daily life in this spectacular city.
Sure. So Teotihuacan, they're located in the basin of Mexico. We'll just start with basic geography there. Teotihuacan developed as a state and as an urban capital of an expansionist state in the early centuries BC, lasted for about 600 years as a very large civilization, and collapsed irrevocably by about AD 650 at least. The Aztecs came much later, and after Teotihuacan collapsed, the region was sort of went through a reorganization where we have these independent city-states that are perhaps political rivals, but definitely political equals, perhaps trading with each other, but nothing on the order of a consolidated state like Teotihuacan. You have these kind of cycles of political centralization and decentralization in the basin of Mexico, and so the legacy that Teotihuacan left was kind of picked up again in the consolidation of the Toltec state or the Toltec Empire, depending on whom you ask and how they feel about how to categorize that. The Aztecs came later, and Teotihuacan is often mistaken for an Aztec site. And indeed, it was a significant settlement in Aztec times. But it's really known for its ruins. And I think Aztecs probably recognized it as a place of ancestors, but as quite a mysterious place. And when you think about it, so the Aztec Empire started in the 15th century. It was pretty short-lived.
It must have been, yes.
Yeah, only lasted until the Spanish conquest, less than 100 years later. And so the Aztecs chronologically are closer to us than they are to Teotihuacan.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Puts perspective
on it. Maybe
we
use Aztec almost generically to mean ancient Mexican civilization. Maybe that's what's
not counting
happened.
The Maya,
right.
Of course.
Yeah, but
just sort of the Toltecs.
I think Aztec and Maya roll off the tongue a little more easily than does Teotihuacan, you know.
Yeah.
So that's perhaps one of the reasons why we're less aware of it as a civilization.
But did they – I mean, we have Aztec writings of some kind, and we have, of course, the calendars of, you know, that we associate with Mexico City and all that. Do we have that with Teotihuacan?
No. We do have writing at Teotihuacan, but it's not writing in the strict sense of sentences with complex grammar. We have these kind of standard notational signs that we see mostly accompanying pictures in mural art, on pottery, sometimes on the floors of living compounds, areas where people lived. They'll be etched onto the floors. We also see graffiti scratched onto the pottery, but we don't know what it means. We can't interpret it at all. And it's often these kind of signs that are really isolated from each other in the sense that we really can't put them together well enough in a pattern to really interpret them. It's a completely different situation for the Maya. And the Maya were a contemporaneous society, so at the same time as Teotihuacan. They actually predate Teotihuacan a little bit and post-date it, but they're located about 600 miles to the east and cover a big, large area of Mesoamerica.
More toward Yucatan.
Yes. So Yucatan, Guatemala, Belize, western Honduras, those
but
areas.
But the Mayas have, and the Aztecs, was there some kind of Rosetta Stone that enables us to have more insight into their writings?
Yeah. The Maya have a lot of carved documents. They're called stelae, located at their sites. And there's also writing on the pottery. Writing was a greater tradition in the Maya area than it was at Teotihuacan. And so you have these artists and scribes that are specialists in writing. And because we see these notational symbols next to each other in the Maya lowlands, people have been able to interpret them. Now, I can't interpret them. I'm not an epigrapher. But there are epigraphers who read the Maya writing. And Teotihuacan is mentioned in Maya writing and on Maya art. There are kings from the west that ascended to the throne that are referred to as foreign kings. For example, AD 378 in January, on a particular date, a person came from the west and ascended the throne of Tikal. And so we have particular historical events that are documented that relate to Teotihuacan somehow, but they're not written by Teotihuacanos. And so that gives us some challenge in interpreting them, in trying to figure out, you know, in the case of the Maya, for example, there are sort of two camps. And one is the camp that takes it at face value and says, certainly it seems that Teotihuacan intervened in the political affairs of the Maya. However long that took, we're not sure about that. Maybe it was for just a short time. But there are people working in the Maya lowlands who would see that more as an appropriation of Teotihuacan symbolism by local Maya rulers in order to legitimate themselves So we have to look at other lines of evidence, archaeological lines of evidence beyond the epigraphy to try and piece that together. And that doesn't always yield a complete agreement anyway, but we do our best.
Sure. And I guess that makes for sort of the silent people then, because they're not having their own voice. What makes this particular civilization, Teotihuacan, unique then? If it doesn't have as much writing or symbolism as the Mayans, if it didn't last as long as some other civilizations elsewhere, what for you makes it an absolutely fantastically unique place?
I guess I just think it is really unprecedented in terms of its monumentality. I mean, there's no other civilization in Mesoamerica that comes close to it. At that point in time, it was just majestic on the landscape as a site, but also one of the most densely populated urban centers, and it changed the entire region in kind of an explosive way. I mean, it grew very rapidly. The rest of the basin was depopulated. About 80 to 90% of the population drained from these outlying areas and concentrated at Teotihuacan. So something going on there was quite compelling for those people. And then you have people that are living there together, speaking different languages, representing different ethnic groups. Teotihuacan, we can tell from evidence elsewhere around the Mesoamerican world, but also at home, that it had these long-distance connections. As archaeologists, we try and figure out, were they connections of diplomacy? Was it political meddling? Mm-hmm. Was it trade? Exactly. And so there are these varying kinds of relationships. But we can see that it was a multicultural place, unlike anything that came before it, and really unlike anything at the same time. It was a multi-ethnic, very densely populated urban city, and I think that's what fascinates me about it and why I think it's so distinctive.
Sure. And what about the political structure? You've mentioned kings and rulers and so on. What's known about the way this place was governed, and any indication of who took part in it?
Those are some major questions for archaeologists who study Teotihuacan as well. its predecessors and its contemporaries tended to celebrate and glorify individual rulers through portraiture, through carved monuments. They were named, and so we have kind of a dynastic history even of the Maya, and this is a civilization at the same time as Teotihuacan. At Teotihuacan, we don't have monuments to individuals. We can't read any of the written names of individuals. And the art that we do see there is so much more abstract and so much simpler in a way than the more natural art of the Maya lowlands. It doesn't look like portraiture. It's more standardized. It's more kind of geometrical and in some cases very kind of natural or floral motifs. But you don't see these individual faces that pop out at you as someone who had a lot of power. So, you know, it's kind of an enigma. We don't really know whether there were divine kings in the sense of the Maya or even the Olmec that came before the Maya, or if it was sort of a republic ruled by a governing council, had a completely different kind of political structure as some of its contemporaries. A lot of research has been done recently trying to locate the tombs of rulers, actually seeking out some person that
not
would
much
have been buried.
Luck, I gather.
Nothing, yeah. It's very fascinating. The pyramids have been excavated, you know, in search of some clues about rulership at Teotihuacan. But what we always find is massive evidence of militarism and human sacrifice. Teotihuacan was not a peaceful society by any means, but we have never found the tomb of any ruler.
So what kind of military? In other words, do you find weapons? Do you find, you know, shackles? What is it that tells you this was a violent place?
Well, for example, there's the Feathered Serpent Pyramid, which is located in that great enclosure of the Ciudadela. And in that pyramid, there are many different burial pits, and the pits themselves seem to be arranged in a very particular way. They include different numbers of individuals per pit, and that these individuals were sacrificed individuals with their hands bound behind their backs in a position that looks to be they were captives or prisoners of war. They're highly decorated, so many of them wear necklaces of carved shell. In some cases, they wear necklaces of human teeth and even necklaces with human maxilla, so the upper jaw. And these are
probably
trophies.
War trophies.
Yeah, exactly. Some of them have actually carved shell pieces that resemble human teeth, and so they symbolize war trophies. But there's 132 individuals in these burials altogether, and those are just the complete skeletons. Probably more than 200 individuals if you count the skeletal parts that are just fragments of human bodies. But these are events that took place during the construction of that pyramid. They were part of the dedication, part of that construction process, which in itself was a very ritualistic kind of process.
What can be deduced about their relationship of men and women at the time? And for example, with the skeletons that were found that look as if they were sacrificed because their hands are bound, is that all men and women?
Actually, it's men and women, and they're separated. So there are pits full of women that were sacrificed and pits full of men. And the men tend to be a little bit older than the women. The women tend to be buried with slightly different offerings, small arrow points with some of the women, and the men have larger spear points and other kinds of carved obsidian eccentrics.
Anything you can conclude about the role that women would have played in this city?
I think it depends on what kind of social group we're talking about. And that's one of my major interests, is getting down to the diversity. And so there's women of upper status, women of lower status, women representing different ethnic groups, and that the differences between men and women might not be so much a difference that we can detect at the general level, but maybe if we look a little bit more closely, you know, what was the experience of a woman living in a common urban neighborhood versus a woman associated with these militaristic rituals of the state, you know. So it's something that we need more detail. We really need greater resolution in order
now,
to answer that.
About the feathered serpent, serpents seem to be recurring symbols in Mexican religion, whether it's, you know, Mayan or others. What is the significance, do you suppose, of the serpent?
You know, for Teotihuacan, it's hard to say. I mean, there are many animals that are represented at Teotihuacan in the iconography. The feathered serpent is probably foremost among them, but also a crocodilian creature that might represent something of the primordial sea, maybe something of the origin mythology. As far as that symbolism, I mean, we really can only guess at what it means. What we do know is that it continues and that,
right.
that it's widespread. And so there are ideas that seem to be pan-Mesoamerican mm-hmm. and definitely have deep, deep longevity. They probably predate Teotihuacan, and they postdate it. They're carried into the Toltec world and into the Aztec Empire. And the meanings that they have in those different societies are likely to have changed just a little bit. You know, what they meant to different people is a whole other question.
In some of the Mesoamerican communities, I think, you know, rain anywhere, of course, would be very important, but in some places it seems to become more of an issue than others. Do we see any evidence of that, you know, this attempt to appease those gods responsible for bringing rain?
Yeah, actually, in the Aztec world, there's a rain god called Tlaloc, and Tlaloc is the Nahuatl word, and we see representations of Tlaloc in the Teotihuacan world as well. We usually call him the storm god rather than Tlaloc, you know, it, just in case they spoke Otomi instead of Nahuatl.
Of course.
But it seems to be the same figure.
And what does it look like, the representation of the storm god?
Well, it's interesting because there are these goggles that it wears around the eyes. A lot of things we have difficulty making sense
Chariots
of, really
of the gods,
understanding.
Here we come.
Yeah. There are also effigy vessels. There are these very popular ceramic jars that are made to look like Tlaloc, and Tlaloc holds a lightning bolt in one of his hands. He wears these goggles. On the top of these vessels is a three mountain symbol, like on the lip, the rim of the vessel that kind of is on his forehead. And, you know, we really don't know what this all means, but what we can do as archaeologists is figure out how widely it was distributed, how significant it was in people's lives. Does everybody subscribe to this kind of symbolism, or do some people not really care about it at all? Is it state related? Is it throughout the general population? So there's a lot of times in archaeology where we really have no idea about the underlying content, the meaning, but really what matters to us is how continuous is it? How widespread is it? And we start to get at the social significance of these symbols.
We'll see if we can find out what happened to this great city and its attendant civilization when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Sarah Clayton, and we are talking about the ancient Mexican civilization of Teotihuacan, talking about this kind of mysterious place that had a lot of people there, wonderful monuments, a very laid-out urban plan, but no written records to tell us what exactly was going on. So there's a lot of educated guesswork going on. Can you tell us about some of the daily life? For example, if you had to put together for tourists a day in the life of someone at this site, what would you show in terms of food and jobs and kind of the different social classes?
I think that's the aspect of Teotihuacan that most fascinates me in my own research. Is figuring out what it would have been like for different people across the population. And, of course, there's the issue of social status and wealth. We definitely see differences in wealth archaeologically that we measure in different quality of architecture, different levels of energy invested in burials, for example, and different qualities of material culture of artifacts that people were able to consume. So nicer pottery versus junkier pottery. So we can see that, and there are some indications that those differences actually increase through time. In fact, we see greater heterogeneity across Teotihuacan early in its history, so that the neighborhoods were quite intermixed in terms of quality of architecture, quality of burials, quality of material culture in general. And then we start to see later on maybe higher status neighborhoods and lower status neighborhoods that are more homogeneous within. And so these status distinctions seem to have increased, and it's possible that, that something like that process ultimately led to the development of factions or internal unrest, tensions that, that might have played a part in the downfall of that society. In terms of everyday life, people lived in a really interesting way that may be difficult for us to relate to in our own society. They lived in groups of maybe 60 to 100 people in very, very large apartment compounds. They had very thick exterior walls around the compound. They had multiple rooms, multiple suites where maybe individual families lived. And then they had central courtyards and patios that were open air, that had altars in many cases where people could worship. But it seems to be a lot of life actually took place within the confines of these different compounds. And these residential units have been somewhat of a mystery to us in terms of how they related to each other. They seem to be extended family with marriage partners coming into compounds over time and leaving compounds. Some of them incorporated immigrants from other parts of Mesoamerica, but not the entire population. So actually, we have some compounds that are mixes of ethnic groups, and then we have some that are look like enclaves, where they're really purely Zapotec from Oaxaca. We can tell by differences in what they were eating, what they were cooking, what their ceramics look like, their burial traditions, their ritual traditions. These are the ways that people perpetuate ethnic identity. And so we can see this ethnic diversity in the material record at Teotihuacan. In some cases, as I mentioned, it's concentrated in different parts of the city, on the margins generally, but it also seems to have been intermixed throughout the population. So the composition of these big residential groups is kind of mysterious, but we do know that they tended to be meaningful groups, that people were tied in a very meaningful way to these compounds. They buried their dead within the compounds, for example. So their ancestors were buried underneath the living floors where they continued to go about their daily lives. And as I mentioned, they worshipped at these altars. They had domestic rituals that were very important that took place within the compounds.
What were the health issues of these populations?
Communicable disease, I'm sure, was an issue. And we do have some wonderful paleodemographic work that's been done only in a limited way, in that there is really extensive work done at one compound. And it would be great if we could continue along those lines and look at other compounds to see if it was the same situation. But there's a great study done by Rebecca Story that shows increasing nutritional deficiencies through time.
Really?
Increasing infant mortality through time. And so whether this was a particularly impoverished residential group or how representative it is.
You'd have to see if it's across all class.
So that's
lines.
one of the best future directions for research is really to try and get a more representative sample of the entire population.
And was this largely a corn-based population?
Yeah, they ate a lot of maize. They ate a lot of maguey, and maguey is something that the people still grow in the basin of Mexico in arid areas today, and they make a drink, an alcoholic beverage called pulque, which is a traditional drink that's celebrated. People still drink it. It's really good. But they made clothing fiber from maguey. They ate prickly pear cactus. As far as animals, they kept turkeys. They ate turkeys. They hunted deer on occasion.
We're not talking about any beasts of burden, though, are we?
No, definitely not. Which makes it all the more impressive that they had these long-distance relationships with people 600 miles away.
All the traffic was foot traffic, and they have this 50-meter-wide avenue for nothing but foot traffic.
Exactly.
What about jobs? I mean, I'm assuming some people are making the pots and What kinds of activity do you see?
We see specialization at Teotihuacan on a really big scale. And so we know that farmers lived in the city, but that a lot of the food might have come from the outskirts or even different locations in the rural areas beyond Teotihuacan. We do have farmers living there, but also full-time craft specialists. And in fact, at the level of the apartment compound, there are these residential groups that specialize in the production of pottery, in the production of obsidian knives and blades and arrows and you name it, production of jewelry, all kinds of different specializations going on. And they're obviously producing for a level beyond household provisioning and consumption.
For export.
Absolutely.
And how far flung have these exports been found?
They find Teotihuacan pottery as far away as Maya sites in Belize. Also, there's a kind of obsidian that Teotihuacan controlled. It's called Pachuca obsidian, and it's a beautiful green, very high-quality obsidian, and we find that all over Mesoamerica. So it seems to have dominated the obsidian trade.
Anything that comes in from the outside that we've found?
Definitely. We have Maya ceramics at Teotihuacan, ceramics from the Gulf lowlands, items from Oaxaca, from West Mexico, and not only the objects, which would be indicative of trade, but also the practices. So West Mexican tomb burials, for example, we see those occurring inside apartment compounds at Teotihuacan, which is not a typical burial practice of Teotihuacan. So we recognize that as indicative of foreigners, of immigrants that have been incorporated into the city population.
So as you said, it was sort of a multicultural center then in a way.
Definitely.
So if you were to look at a pot from this place, how would you know it was from there as opposed to Aztec or Mayan or Incan or something? What would you immediately spot that would tell you it's from Teotihuacan?
Well, stylistically, they stand out, the pottery from any of these areas. Normally, when you specialize in one of these areas, you start to recognize the typical painting styles, the motifs, the texture of the clay. But for Teotihuacan in particular, a lot of it was quite standardized. I mean, so people were producing not just for the household, but for probably a marketplace exchange situation, and in many cases making objects for tribute to pay to the state as a form of taxation. And so a lot of the pottery looks a lot the same. It's made in a particular range of forms, kind of limited range of forms, and with specific designs that people would have been interested in purchasing in the market, perhaps, and that people would have recognized. And so it's kind of easy to identify. If you spend a couple of days, even a week, looking at Teotihuacan pottery, you can kind of recognize it after that.
What about musical instruments?
We do see musical instruments all over Mesoamerica and at Teotihuacan as well, but rasps made from bone, some even made from human bone, rattles, where you have little ceramic balls that shake around inside a larger ceramic piece, flutes, whistles, that sort of thing. It was a musical place. Definitely drums. You could have put a hide over an open ceramic vessel and played the drums that way. And
where does it all start to go wrong? I mean, you mentioned the nutritional downslide in this one place, but where do we start seeing things unraveling at Teotihuacan?
It seems to have been in decline during the last 50 to 100 years, and that would be between 550 and 650 or so, we think, and we're always refining those dates. We get new radiocarbon dates, or and things become a little bit more resolved. But around that time, Teotihuacan is not investing in architecture. They're not building monuments. And they seem to be sort of in decline for a while, but they do go out with a bang. I mean, it's very violent ending to Teotihuacan. There's evidence of burning in at least 140 structures along the Avenue of the Dead, some of the central structures and central monuments and temples. There are sculptures that are pushed to the ground and scattered, broken.
So we can put a pretty specific date on that, I assume.
We can kind of narrow it down to really 50 years, maybe the last 50 years. But it's I'm sure this was a major event. I mean, this is something that happened maybe only over a period of a few days. But in terms of determining when those few days were, that's the difficulty.
But it looks like the sack of the city?
Yes, yes.
Inside,
the sack
outside.
Of the city. That's the other question. Inside, outside. There's really no strong evidence for an external force attacking Teotihuacan yet. I mean, we do see that there are immigrants, there are newcomers coming into the Basin of Mexico at about this time. And it comes down largely to a question of timing. Did they arrive before Teotihuacan fell? Or did they come in and occupy the area in its wake? And so that remains a question, but I think my feeling is that it was probably internal factors, a weakening of leadership, perhaps.
And you mentioned also that it seemed as if wealth was less evenly distributed toward the end,
yes,
as well, which would,
yeah,
create resentment, perhaps.
Right.
Are there ever political ramifications to discoveries of this nature where you say, oh, well, class warfare and the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer and suddenly the whole thing tips over?
I think so. I mean, I think there are lessons in prehistory to learn. I mean, we're still trying to figure out exactly what combination of factors led to the downfall. But it seems to be that as bureaucracies get really large, they also become perhaps kind of rigid, maybe sluggish, maybe a little less able to cope effectively with changing circumstances, less able to adapt. And perhaps this influx of people, whether that was the actual cause or not, I mean, maybe that just kind of tipped things in a direction that the leaders at Teotihuacan really couldn't deal with, couldn't handle. There may have been a loss of faith in leadership. People aren't doing as well. There's high mortality rates, low nutrition. So
yes,
less satisfaction
overall.
Yes, the low
nutrition is kind of intriguing, isn't it? Yeah.
Right.
And if we had you back in 10 years and all the research you were wanting to do and other people's research in this area had taken place, what would you most hope you would know that you don't now?
That's an excellent question. I think one of the most important directions we can go in is to understand it from a larger scale. So we've preserved Teotihuacan, the downtown area, as a city, and much of the research as a consequence has been fairly city-centric. And what we need to know in order to kind of piece these processes together more effectively is more about what was happening in the greater Basin of Mexico, what was happening in the rural area. How early were the rural settlements maybe settled by these newcomers, these migrants that were coming in from the north at the end of Teotihuacan? Were they resistant to the state? What was even the organization? Were they heavily taxed? Were they heavily burdened? Did they socially identify with Teotihuacan? So we need to expand outward a bit and understand it more as a regional phenomenon rather than just simply a city that's fascinating in its own right.
But when we say Teotihuacan, we're not talking about just the city. We're actually talking about a genetic population, too.
Yeah, I think there was probably a mainstream population of Teotihuacanos. In the beginnings, though, it was really a coming together of several different people, and maybe kind of a synoikistic process, uh-huh, where you have whole communities coming together. And so it certainly was a mix throughout its history in genetic terms.
And if someone asked you, why should we care? You know, why should all this work in excavating and understanding this civilization take place? Why should we care?
I think there's a couple different levels to that. I mean, one is that it's a fascinating, rich, distinctive, unique civilization, and that it's worthwhile to know about just for its own sake. This is the cultural heritage of the people living in that area still today, and so it's interesting on that level. But I do think it has lessons in terms of figuring out, you know, what we conceive of as sustainable practices politically, ecologically. What do we consider success? In terms of civilizations and states, do we inevitably fail? Would this have gone on in perpetuity if certain things hadn't gone wrong? What did they do right? What did they do wrong? I think we can learn from that. And Teotihuacan is, of course, not the only case. And what it does is contribute to these questions in a broader way by giving us a comparative example. So this is a finite civilization we can trace from its early inception through the next 6 centuries all the way to its ultimate dissolution. And we can look at the factors that were involved and consider those in the context of a more global perspective, looking at other ancient states as well, figure out if it's always kind of the same things we're seeing or if historicity, the unique kind of situations and unique settings and circumstances, if that's what we need to look more carefully at to understand these processes.
Well, 600 years of history, you'll have a lot to sift through. You'll have your work cut out for you.
Definitely.
Our guest has been Sarah Clayton telling us about Teotihuacan, which is a fascinating American phenomenon, and it sounds like a fascinating place to visit.
It is. I love it. I would recommend it. It's so accessible, too. I mean, it's just across the border. So anyone who's interested, it's definitely a neat place to visit and can be easily visited with a quick trip to Mexico City.
Thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.